Hello and welcome to Business World, a weekly program focusing on personal finance, retirement planning, and developments affecting the global economy. Readings are selected from Bloomberg, Forbes, Fortune, CNBC, and other financial publications. I'm listener-supported Sunsounds of Arizona volunteer reader Mike Amy. This article is posted to Bloomberg. The title, Stocks Rise, Yields Fall as PPI Spurs Fed Cut Bets. Markets Wrap. S&P 500 extends its weekly gain as earnings season kicks off. Oil climbs as strikes against Houthis raise Middle East risks. This was written by Rita Nazareth, posted on January 11, 2024, Friday. Stocks rose and Treasury two-year yields hit the lowest since May as an unexpected decline in producer prices reinforced bets on Federal Reserve rate cuts this year. While traders continued to expect the first rate reduction in May, they now see a slightly bigger chance of a cut in March. The data came just a day after a hotter-than-anticipated reading on consumer prices, underscoring the bumpy path officials face in bringing inflation back to the 2% target. Wall Street also sifted through a raft of bank results as corporate America's earnings season got underway. Geopolitical risks also captured investors' attention. We suspect there is little to dissuade the market from pressing the March cut trade and wouldn't fade the move ahead of the weekend, said Ben Jeffrey at BMO Capital Markets. Let us not forget the geopolitical escalations in the Red Sea and the implied headline risk, relevant from both a flight to quality and supply-side inflation perspective, he said. Two-year U.S. yields fell 9 basis points to 4.16%. The S&P 500 extended its weekly advance. Oil jumped as the U.S. and its allies launched airstrikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen, retaliating for attacks on ships in the Red Sea that have imperiled flows of fuel and goods through the vital waterway. To Chris Larkin at E-Trade from Morgan Stanley, maybe a bit of a stretch to describe today's cooler-than-expected numbers as a surprise, given that producer prices have already been retreating faster than consumer inflation for quite a while. The market has tended to run with any data that fits the falling inflation means lower interest rates narrative, but we'll see if that storyline bumps up against the reality of a market that has already priced in multiple rate cuts, he noted. Corporate highlights. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company closed out the most profitable year in U.S. banking history, with its seventh consecutive quarter of record net interest income and a surprise forecast that the windfall may continue this year. Wells Fargo & Company fourth quarter costs came in higher than expected, swollen by severance charges and the bank's contribution to replenish the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp's main fund after bank failures last year. Citigroup Incorporated said it will eliminate 20,000 roles in a move that will save it as much as $2.5 billion as part of Chief Executive Officer Jane Fraser's quest to boost the Wall Street giant's lagging returns. Bank of America Corp's earnings fell short of expectations as the bank's numerous charges in the fourth quarter cut into profit and the firm's fixed income traders posted a surprise drop in revenue. BlackRock clients jumped into its long-term funds in the fourth quarter, adding $63 billion to ETFs and other products in a sign investors put cash to work as stock and bond markets surged. Delta Airlines backed away from its 2024 profit target as persistently high costs countered the gains from a rebound in international travel. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration said it will increase its oversight of Boeing Company's production and manufacturing operations a day after it opened a formal investigation into the plane maker over last week's accident on a 737 MAX 9 jet. UnitedHealth Group, Incorporated reported higher fourth-quarter medical costs than Wall Street analysts expected, even as overall results beat estimates. Some of the main moves in the market: stocks, S&P rose 0.3% as of 9:53 a.m. New York time on Friday. The NASDAQ 100 rose 0.4%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was little changed. The Stocks Europe 600 rose 1%. The MSCI World Index rose 0.6%. In currencies, the Bloomberg Dollar's spot index fell 0.2%. The euro was little changed at $1.09. The British pound was little changed at $1.28. Japanese yen rose 0.5% to 144.55 per dollar. In cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin fell 1.4% to $45,523.30, and Ether rose 3.6% to $2,696.48. In bonds, the yield on 10-year treasuries declined 4 basis points to 3.92%. Germany's 10-year yield declined 6 basis points to 2.18%. Britain's 10-year yield declined 7 basis points to 3.77%. And in commodities, West Texas Intermediate crude oil rose 3.1% to $74.24 a barrel. Spot gold rose 1.4% to $2,057.71 an ounce. And again, the title of this, and I'm seeing at the bottom of this article that it was produced partly by artificial intelligence. Stocks rise, yields fall as PPI spurs Fed cut bets, markets wrap. This article is posted to CNBC. The title, BlackRock's Larry Fink says Bitcoin ETFs are just the first step in the technological revolution of finance. This was published on Friday, January 12, 2024. It was written by Tanaya McKeel. Key points. BlackRock CEO Larry Fink says ETFs are step one of the technological revolution in the financial markets on CNBC's Squawk Box. Step two is tokenization, he said. Tokenization of real-world assets such as gold has gained popularity among financial institutions who are cautious on crypto assets but keen on the underlying blockchain technology. Fink said he sees value in an Ether ETF, but that it's a mere stepping stone to tokenization. Here's the article. Bitcoin exchange traded funds have arrived after a hard-fought battle between the crypto industry and the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, the biggest asset manager in the world, thinks it's just the first step toward a new financial world. ETFs were seen as a way to give investors exposure to a young and risky asset class, but the value blockchain technology provider goes beyond Bitcoin, and the new ETFs are just a precursor to broader tokenization of other assets, Fink told CNBC's Squawk Box on Friday. ETFs are just one of the technological revolution in the financial markets, he said. Step two is going to be the tokenization of every financial asset, he said. Before BlackRock filed its application for a Bitcoin ETF in June and created a groundswell of optimism that such a fund could become a reality, tokenization of real-world assets such as gold had been revived as a hot topic among financial institutions who claimed this would give institutions the ability to provide more information and data to clients about their investments. Some see Bitcoin as the beginning of a bigger push by crypto into the legacy financial system. After the approval of Bitcoin ETFs, investors are looking forward to the first deadline for the SEC to approve or deny spot Ether ETFs, which is scheduled for May. Fink appeared more focused on the deployment of blockchain technology to upgrade existing systems, although some financial heavy hitters such as BlackRock have warmed to Bitcoin over the years and the idea of offering Bitcoin exposure to clients, there's a big crypto world beyond Bitcoin that many will continue to remain cautious on, at least publicly, he said. I see value in having the ETH ETF, he said. As I said, there are just stepping stones toward tokenization. We have the technology to tokenize today, he added. If you had a tokenized security, the moment you buy or sell an instrument, it's known it's on a general ledger that is all created together. This eliminates all corruption, having a tokenized system, he said. Again, the title of that, BlackRock's Larry Fink says Bitcoin ETFs are just the first step in the technological revolution of finance. This article is posted to Fortune. The title, Wholesale Prices in December Went in Reverse Even as Consumer Inflation Heated Up. This by Paul Wiseman, the Associated Press, and Irina Ivanova was published on Friday, January 12, 2024. Wholesale inflation in the United States fell in December, further evidence that price pressures in the economy are easing. The Labor Department reported Friday that its producer price index, which tracks inflation before it reaches consumers, declined 0.1% from November to December. Measured year over year, producer prices rose by a mild 1%. Excluding volatile food and energy costs, so-called core wholesale prices were unchanged from November and up 1.8% from a year earlier. Core inflation, by omitting prices that tend to fluctuate from month to month, is seen by many economists as a better guide to the direction of inflation. It's the third month in a row that has seen falling producer prices, reinforcing the view that U.S. inflation pressures are slowing, if not always consistently. The producer figures, which reflect prices charged by manufacturers, farmers, and wholesalers, can eventually influence what consumers pay. The pipeline of inflation is clearing, and consumer prices will slowly get to the Fed's 2% target, said Jeffrey Roach, chief economist at LPL Financial. After reaching a four-decade high in mid-2022, inflation has slowed sharply in the face of 11 interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve, but there have been blips along the way. On Thursday, for example, the government reported that its closely watched index of consumer prices unexpectedly picked up pace in December, driven mainly by housing and energy costs. But core consumer prices rose just 0.3% from November, unchanged from the previous month, and 3.9% from a year earlier, the mildest 12-month pace since 2021. The latest wholesale inflation figures indicate that consumer prices will likely follow. What inflation risks remain in the U.S. economy clearly cannot be sourced to any upward pressure in producers' costs, Kurt Rankin, senior economist at PNC Financial Services Group, said in a note. The Fed began aggressively raising its benchmark rate in March 2022 to try to slow borrowing and spending and cool inflation. But as inflation measures have edged closer to its 2% year-over-year target, the central bank has let interest rates unchanged since July. Last month, the Fed's policymakers signaled they expected to reverse direction and cut rates three times this year. Some Wall Street investors had expected the rate cuts to start as soon as March, earlier than most economists have envisioned. December's faster-than-expected consumer inflation may mean that the Fed will hold off on rate cutting until later in the year. Fed's hikes in 2022 and 23 raised its benchmark rate to a 23-year high of around 5.4%, despite higher borrowing costs. The U.S. economy and job market have proved surprisingly resilient. The unemployment rate, for example, remains just 3.7% and has come in below 4% for 23 straight months, the longest such streak since the 1960s. combination of slowing inflation and a sturdy economy has raised hopes that Fed can pull off a rare soft landing, raising interest rates enough to tame inflation without tipping the economy into recession. And the title of that infortune, wholesale prices in December, went in reverse even as consumer inflation heated up. This article is posted to a blog, a newsletter, by Fortune Magazine, their Fortune Crypto newsletter. The title is, Bitcoin's $4.6 billion ETF debut was a success. This was posted by Jeff John Roberts on Friday, January 12, 2024. Took a decade of waiting, but Bitcoin finally got its ETF moment. On Thursday, shares from BlackRock and nine other ETF issuers began trading, and so far, it looks like the new product is a hit. The Wall Street Journal described the moment as a monstrous start for Bitcoin's ETFs, while Bloomberg wrote that the new shares took Wall Street by storm. As proof of success, market watchers pointed out that $4.6 billion worth of Bitcoin ETF shares changed hands, suggesting demand for the product was both broad and deep. BlackRock fund alone saw over $1 billion of trading volume, which came close to being the biggest ETF debut in history, not far behind the $1.16 billion in volume that the firm's carbon transition ETF notched in the first day in 2021. The volume numbers are impressive, but there are also some caveats. One is that a good chunk of Thursday's volume likely came as a result of outflows from Grayscale, which uplisted its off-brand trust shares into an ETF, but is maintaining an outsized fee, and from the fact that BlackRock and others had prearranged seed capital, quote-unquote, for their new funds to goose initial demand. It will take a few weeks until we get a clear idea of whether the first-day enthusiasm for the new Bitcoin ETFs translates into long-term demand, including from retail investors. But for now, it's safe to say that the new products are not a bust. Meanwhile, a few other storylines emerged. These included asset management giant Vanguard electing not to offer the ETFs on its platform because the company believes they are too risky. The decision carries a whiff of paternalism, and some may suspect of sour grapes, too, since Vanguard, unlike BlackRock, Fidelity, and Franklin Templeton, did not spin up a Bitcoin ETF of its own. But as Vanguard has made similar decisions in the past over what it perceives as high-risk assets, its no-Bitcoin policy is likely rooted in genuine, if misguided, concern for its customers, Jeff John Roberts wrote. Another emerging story is that in the face-off between traditional finance firms and pure crypto players to offer Bitcoin ETFs, the former appeared to have worn out. As it turned out, claims of Bitcoin authenticity or whatever lost out to the huge liquidity and familiar brand name offered by BlackRock and others. Finally, the launch of the ETFs has proved an occasion to reflect on what Bitcoin even stands for anymore. Some have noted it is ironic that a project that began as a rebellion to big banks and the government has gone mainstream in the form of Wall Street packaging. I think that's beside the point, though, says Jeff John Roberts. If people want to exchange Bitcoin outside of the financial system, they absolutely can do it, and it's cheaper to boot. And here are some headlines. Decentralized news. New York's Department of Financial Services stripped Genesis of its Bit license as part of an $8 million settlement with a DCG subsidiary. Circle filed for a confidential IPO after the stablecoin giant unsuccessfully tried to go public via a SPAC in 2022. Franklin Templeton, whose Bitcoin ETF attracted less interest than those of Fidelity or Vanguard, slashed its fee to 0.19%. CoinShares exercised an option to buy the Bitcoin ETF business of rival Valkyrie following its soft debut on Thursday. And the share prices of Coinbase, MicroStrategy, and Bitcoin mining stocks all slumped on the day of the ETF's debut. Again, that's a blog by Jeff John Roberts. Bitcoin's $4.6 billion ETF debut was a success. This article is posted to Bloomberg. The title, "Large Backers of Private Equity Are Asking for Their Money Back. Sovereign wealth funds and others want to unlock their previous investments before putting in more money." This was posted by Laura Benitez, Silas Brown, and David Ramley on Friday, January 11, 2024. Some of the most influential investors are giving the world's largest private equity firms a message. If you want money for your next fund, here's our list of demands. Sovereign wealth funds and state pension providers are among investors telling money managers they'll only commit in their upcoming fundraisers if their capital, tied up in old funds, is released, according to people with knowledge of the matter. Additional requests range from fee discounts and more co-investment opportunities to greater information rights and representation on committees, the people said, asking not to be identified because the requests are private. Some are even asking for a cut of the fund's management fee or an opportunity to buy a stake in the fund manager, the people added. "We're now undergoing a real cultural change," said William Barrett, managing partner at Reach Capital, a private market fundraising firm. "It's the first time we're seeing LPs being so straightforward and linking a distribution from one fund to a new commitment in another. They've never been so precise with their asks," he said. The relationship between private equity firms such as Blackstone and Apollo Global Management and their backers is symbiotic. Large fund managers cannot scale their platforms without money from the biggest so-called limited partners, while the investors need managers with a capacity to accept large swaths of capital. But the balance of power is shifting within the $8 trillion private equity industry as buyout funds struggle to return money to investors amid disagreements between buyers and sellers over corporate valuations. That's handing more power to LPs to dictate the terms of engagement. As money rolling into private equity slowed last year, the heft of a handful of funds who make the majority of investments into private markets, such as sovereign wealth funds from the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, had become even more persuasive. Just 5 years ago, funds from the Middle East didn't make the top 10 state-owned investors of private markets, according to data from Global SWF. By 2023, five were from the Gulf, including Abu Dhabi's ADQ and ADIA. In some circumstances, funds include ADIA and Singaporean sovereign wealth fund GIC, among investors specifically asking for distributions to be returned to them from older vintages as they discuss upcoming fundraises, some of the people said. To be sure, one person familiar with the matter said, GIC makes selective investments into new funds without taking capital from previous vintages. Other requests from some SWFs include demands for more disclosures about the underlying assets in portfolios, the people said. The investors are asking for more information about their investments than ever before, with demands sometimes coming weekly, some of the people said. U.S. PE exit activity fell to an unprecedented low last year relative to the industry's hoard of capital under management, according to PitchBook, with the current median holding period of investments exited reaching 6.4 years, the highest in more than a decade. This year's forecast indicates that buyout fundraising is expected to be approximately 30% below its current linear trend, PitchBook data showed, while trailing 12-month buyout fund distributions through the first quarter of 2023 hit their lowest level since the global financial crisis, the data said. It's a tough market, and LPs are using the leverage they have, particularly the largest investors of private credit, such as the sovereign wealth funds and state pension plan funds, Barrett said. Fund managers have to fight for their dollars now, and investors know this, he said. One commonly used justification for LPs asking for cash back is the so-called denominator effect, where the value of assets from real estate to public stock have proven volatile in recent years. Private equity valuations have largely remained steady, at least on paper. This has meant that in some instances, investors have liquidated private holdings to avoid breaching allocations guidelines designed to safeguard the long-term safety of funds. That's combined with many institutional investors from Singapore to Canada coming more conservative. However, fund managers have been slow to sell fund assets into the current uncertain markets, indicating a reluctance to crystallize asset values that may be lower than expected. Instead, many are using leverage to release funds. Historically, if you invested into a PE fund, your capital was locked in for 10 to 11 years, said Jeff Johnston, head of fund finance at Everbank. Now there are more and more ways through leverage and secondary sales to try and get the capital back, he said. The strategy of using so-called net asset value, or NAV financing, a loan backed by a pool of portfolio companies, has become more widely used. The loans are typically costly, and critics warn they're likely to dilute returns later down the line. Vista Equity Partners generated $18 billion in total value by cashing in on bets since late 2021, but it still signed a $1.5 billion NAV loan in March last year that earmarked $500 million for investor distributions, according to a person with knowledge of the matter. A representative for Vista declined to comment. David Philip, a partner at Crestline Investors, whose Fort Worth, Texas-based firm provides NAV loans to money managers, said there's been an uptick in LPs requesting capital back and asking for general partners to explore NAV lending to facilitate a portfolio-level recap. This is often stemming from a sponsor soliciting the LPs to re-up in an upcoming fund prior to delivering money back from previous vintages, Philip said. Some PE firms are also taking out loans at the management company level to help meet fund commitments. So-called Manco loans are typically backed by assets, including the promise of future fee income, and can charge interest into the higher teens. Private equity increased use of leverage can sometimes come at a cost for other LPs in the fund who haven't opted for the fund to add leverage, according to Crestline's Philip. We've seen a few cases where the majority of LPs have voted in favor of NAV and the rest have not, and they're then forced to take expensive liquidity, he said. That obviously can create some issues unless the minority group of LPs are given an ability to opt out or give an attractive reinvestment option to neutralize the cost, he said. As sovereign wealth and pension funds raise their scrutiny and demands over private markets, firms including those in the $1.6 trillion private credit market, some are increasingly lending directly to borrowers and cutting out direct lending giants altogether. The Canada Pension Plan Investment Board and GIC, which typically provide funds to private credit giants to deploy, directly offered among the largest portion of a 4.5 euro loan backing Blackstone and Permira Holdings' purchase of European online classified company Adevinta in November, Bloomberg had previously reported. LPs are generally becoming more and more educated in private market investing, said Reach Capital's Barrett, The next question will be, when will some of the biggest backers of this sector begin building their own in-house origination teams and start cutting out the middleman? And the title of that, which is posted to Bloomberg, Large Backers of Private Equity Are Asking for Their Money Back. You're listening to Business World, a weekly program focusing on personal finance, retirement planning, and developments affecting the global economy. I'm listener-supported Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader Mike Amy. This article is posted to Bloomberg. The title, There's Finally Hope for the Office Real Estate Market. Brokerage JLL says more bidders are re-entering the market. Firm forecasts that property owners will need more equity. This was written by Natalie Wong. Was posted Thursday, January 11th, 2024. Soaring borrowing costs and plunging prices walloped the global commercial property market last year. Now, more clarity around values and an urgent need to address looming debt maturities are expected to spark more deals. Sellers and buyers are finally seeing more opportunities to transact after uncertainty nearly froze the market for much of last year. The average number of bids per deal climbed 16% in November 2023 from the end of 2022, according to Jones Lang LaSalle Incorporated. And the opportunity may be vast. The brokerage estimates that property owners with loans maturing through the end of 2025 will need as much as $570 billion in new equity, given how sharply values have fallen. With some central banks starting to signal that the rapid rate hiking cycle is winding down, investors have gained more insight into borrowing costs. And several real estate deals, including the sale of roughly $33 billion in commercial property debt from the failed Signature Bank, have also provided more transparency on values. The clarity is starting to spur some optimism in the beleaguered market. We're seeing more bids and we're seeing more tours, Michael Gigliotti, a senior managing director at JLL, said in a phone interview. You have maturing loans, you have dry capital, you have parties interested in investing in real estate. The market still needs to see a longer period of stability with interest rates to fully unlock the capital that's on the sidelines, according to JLL, and many owners may wait to transact until values stabilize even more or potentially start rising. But with more than $3 trillion of property around the world that has debt set to mature through 2025, many owners need to figure out what to do with certain properties and debt in the coming months, according to JLL. The debt markets are stabilizing, so there's less yield to be made in debt, so there's more people now looking at equity, said Adam Spies, co-head of U.S. Capital Markets at Newmark Group. People feel that they're not at the top anymore, looking over a cliff, but perhaps at the bottom, looking up. Investors feel like it's a good time to start making investments, he said. Other firms are seeing early signs that the commercial real estate market is starting to settle more. Real estate analytics company Green Street said its index of commercial property prices was flat in December from a month earlier. The correction in real estate pricing that began 2 years ago appears to have run its course, Peter Rothamund, co-head of strategic research at Green Street, said in a statement on January 5th. Commercial real estate is now fairly priced versus yields on corporate bonds, and market pricing of listed real estate investment trusts suggests something similar, he said. There's evidence that buyers' interest is perking up for some Manhattan Towers, an office building in Manhattan's Tribeca neighborhood at 101 Franklin Street, which is being marketed by Newmark as a potential residential conversion, has attracted dozens of tours and received more than a dozen bids, according to people familiar with the matter who asked not to be named, citing private details. The seller, Columbia Property Trust is asking around $115 million for the property, more than 40% off the price it paid in 2019, and is also offering potential financing for the deal, the People said. A representative for Columbia Property Trust declined to comment. DWS Group office tower in the Financial District at 222 Broadway is also being pitched as a conversion opportunity and has attracted many potential investors seeking to tour the building, one of the people said. A DWS representative declined to comment. Josh Ramani, a co-founder of Empire Capital Holdings, has been actively bidding on and buying up New York offices over the past 2 years as he seeks to invest in commercial property on behalf of wealthy families. But now more bidders are joining the fray, he said. There was a vacant building I was bidding on, but the price went up beyond where we were willing to take it a month ago, so there's more activity, Ramani said. If you have a motivated seller and they have to sell now, the price is what the market can bear, which is still at great discounts, he said. Federal Reserve kept its benchmark rate steady at its meeting in December, while also signaling the end of the most aggressive tightening cycle in a generation. Property owners who don't have to urgently sell may be inclined to hold on to assets if rates come down, he said. But the refinancing shortfall, which ranges between $270 billion and $570 billion, according to JLL, could spur some owners to put assets or loans up for sale, including distressed transactions in some cases. On the other side, potential buyers and investors are flush with funds. JLL said that there's $402 billion of dry powder for commercial real estate, according to data as of October. This reset in values will both challenge capital and catalyze liquidity, Richard Bloxam, chief executive officer of capital markets at JLL, said in a statement. There's absolutely uniform understanding that pricing has changed. Given the quantum of dry powder, there will be a considerable first-mover advantage for capital that can deploy quickly and mobilize around opportunities as markets fundamentals improve, he said. Some buyers have deployed capital into major deals recently. In December, the luxury retailer Prada S.p.A. and an entity tied to the Prada family purchased two buildings on New York's Fifth Avenue for a total of $835 million, one of the largest property deals in the city last year. Well-known properties in California also found buyers. University of California agreed to pay $700 million for a former Los Angeles shopping mall that had been redeveloped as offices for Alphabet's Google. The university plans to convert it to a medical and engineering research park. The Aon Center in downtown L.A. sold for $147.8 million, about 45% less than its previous purchase price in 2014. The investment arm of property firm Kasson Sabah Realty purchased a 49% stake in a 34-story Manhattan office building at 1410 Broadway in Manhattan. The building, owned by L.H. Charney Associates, was previously leased to WeWork, but the co-working firm's lease was terminated prior to its bankruptcy filing. Since then, more space has been leased, bringing the tower's occupancy up to more than 90%. Now that rates appear that they aren't going to be going up anymore, it's giving buyers assurances that they won't be in a worse situation 6 months from now in trying to close or get a loan, said Albert Sultan, a broker at KSR. There's a handful of players that have returned to the market. Not a ton, but that gives me optimism that things will return overall, he said. U.S. could be a particularly interesting spot, according to JLL. Of the $3.1 trillion property assets with maturing debt through the end of 2025, more than three-quarters of that are concentrated in the United States, specifically in the residential and office sectors, the brokerage said. The U.S. is furthest along in its cycle, which could draw more attention from buyers hoping to catch the bottom of the price decline. That includes major players such as Morgan Stanley's real estate investing platform, which is seeking out opportunities that arise from the turmoil in the industry. Certainly, a lot of investors are interested in investing in real estate when they think they're picking the bottom, JLL's Gigliotti said. Yeah, the title of that article posted to Bloomberg, there finally are hopes for the office real estate market. This article is posted to the Your Money Advisors section of the New York Times. Title is IRS to begin trial of its own free tax filing system. Residents of 12 states are eligible to participate if they meet certain criteria, but the agency's plans have already met resistance from tax preparation companies. This was written by Ann Carnes, published on January 5th, 2024. The Internal Revenue Service is rolling out a free option for filing federal tax returns this year to some residents of a dozen states. Last month, the agency published details of its plan to test an in-house filing system in which taxpayers submit their federal tax returns directly to the agency online at no cost. Residents of 12 states are eligible to participate if they meet certain criteria. This is a critical step forward for this innovative effort that will test the feasibility of providing taxpayers a new option to file their returns for free directly with the IRS, Danny Werfel, the agency's commissioner, said in a recent statement. While the direct filing system is starting on a limited basis, it has already faced some resistance, particularly from commercial tax preparation companies. A spokeswoman for Intuit, Tania Mercado, criticized the direct file project as a half-baked solution and a waste of taxpayer money. The direct file scheme is a solution in search of a problem, she said. Intuit makes the TurboTax tax preparation software. Democrats in Congress generally support the idea of free direct filing, while Republicans contend that the idea, part of President Biden's plan to overhaul the IRS, would give the agency even more power over ordinary taxpayers. The direct file pilot will be open to low and moderate income taxpayers with simple returns. To be eligible, for instance, filers must take the standard deduction and have income limited to wages reported on Form W-2, Social Security, or unemployment, as well as interest income of $1,500 or less. Gig workers are not eligible. The IRS said in November that it expected at least several hundred thousand taxpayers to participate in what it called a limited pilot. Many filers already have the option to prepare and submit free electronic returns based on their income, either through IRS FreeFile, a partnership with do-it-yourself tax software firms, or directly through some commercial providers. The IRS also provides online forms that any filer can use, regardless of income, to file returns at no cost. The IRS FreeFile program, however, has had mixed results. The nonprofit newsroom ProPublica has reported, for instance, that Intuit's TurboTax program steered users away from its free version. Intuit no longer participates in IRS FreeFile, although it offers its software free to certain users. All those free options remain available, the IRS said, and its test version will just be another option. But with the new direct file service, the IRS aims to further streamline the filing process. In one possible scenario, included in the agency's report to Congress, the IRS could fill out tax returns with information it already has, like data from W-2 wage statements. For the pilot, however, participants will have to enter their own financial information, the IRS said. The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 ordered the IRS to study direct filing. In May, the agency submitted a report to Congress that found a majority of taxpayers would be interested in using a direct file tool, and it began preparing for a pilot test. In the report, the IRS estimated that the annual cost of a direct file system could range from $64 million to $249 million, depending on the scope of the service. A separate report from the Treasury Department Inspector General for Tax Administration, however, said the design of the surveys conducted in the earlier report might have overstated taxpayer interest and that the department couldn't determine the reasonableness of the agency's cost estimates. The pilot system was built at the IRS by a team of tax experts, product managers, software engineers, designers, and data scientists, according to the agency. The IRS said it was collaborating with special teams within the government that help agencies develop digital services. The IRS says Direct File will walk users through the steps of preparing a return, as commercial software does. The service will be mobile-friendly and available in English and Spanish. Users can get help from the agency via a live online chat function and will have the option to speak with a customer service representative on the phone if needed. In online summaries, the agency has said that to make sure the pilot works well, it will initially be open to a small group of taxpayers during the 2024 filing season. As the season progresses, more and more eligible taxpayers will be able to use the service, they say. We're starting small to get it right, the agency said in an update. The IRS said it would promote the filing option in part through its network of grassroots and community partners, like the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, which provides free tax help for low and moderate income filers and for people with disabilities. The agency said it planned to issue a public report on the pilot before deciding if the direct filing system should be open to more taxpayers. Here are some questions and answers about the upcoming tax filing season. What states are included in the pilot? Arizona, California, Florida, Massachusetts, Nevada, New Hampshire, New York, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Washington State, and Wyoming are participating. Most of those states don't tax income at the state level, but the four that do, Arizona, California, Massachusetts, and New York, will guide participants to a state-supported tool they can use to submit their state returns. It's exciting this is happening, said Gabriel Zucker, Associate Policy Director for Tax Benefits at Code for America, a nonprofit organization that builds digital tools to help taxpayers get access to government services. The group is building state electronic filing software for Arizona and New York that participants in the IRS pilot can use to file their state returns. We do expect it can take the headache out of filing, Mr. Zucker said. According to an announcement from Governor Kathy Hochul's office, direct file users in New York will be able to share the information on their federal returns with Code for America filing tool. The tool will prepare most of the state return using the data provided, and most taxpayers will have to answer no more than a few simple questions to complete the New York return. How soon can I file my income taxes this year? IRS hasn't announced a start date for filing returns for tax year 2023, but it's typically in late January. When is the tax filing deadline this year? Federal tax filing deadline for 2023 returns is April 15th. For most filers, state filing deadlines may vary. Again, the title of that article posted to the New York Times, IRS to begin trial of its own free tax filing system. This article is posted to Reuters on Friday, January 12, 2024. The title, Remarkable Surge in Auto Insurance Costs Fans U.S. Inflation. Even as U.S. inflation has eased in the past year, an unusual culprit has emerged in recent months as a surprise force in preventing consumer prices from falling even further: auto insurance. Consumer prices in December overall rose 3.4% from a year earlier, the Labor Department said on Thursday in the release of the monthly Consumer Price Index, more than the 3.2% economists polled by Reuters had expected, and up from 3.1% in November. Several familiar categories accounted for much of the overshoot, with stubbornly high shelter costs in particular accounting for close to two-thirds of the increase, but the highest annual increase for car insurance in nearly half a century made a notable upwards contribution that may not be fading soon. The behavior of the MVI, that is, motor vehicle insurance component of the CPI, has truly been remarkable, and I don't see any evidence of near-term relief, Tom Simons, U.S. economist at Jefferies, said in an email. Motor vehicle insurance premiums skyrocketed by 20.3% in December from a year earlier, the largest increase since the mid-1970s, the government data showed. Premiums have risen persistently all year on a monthly basis, too, climbing 1.5% last month. That's roughly on par with the average monthly increase over the last year, a rate that exceeds all monthly increases prior to the pandemic. What's more, auto insurance, an expense category that has rarely registered as a hefty influence in overall inflation, accounted for 15% of headline price increases over the final quarter of 2023. Simons said several factors are adding to the rising premiums, such as increasing costs for labor and parts to repair damaged vehicles, and the overall rise in vehicle prices over the last several years, which lifts the underlying collateral being insured. Declining demand from insurers is also a factor, he said, and natural disaster risk is probably contributing on the margin. Auto insurance is typically regulated on a state-by-state basis, and costs are subject to major regional differences. We may have some authorities there as well, but those sit with independent agencies, White House National Economic Council Director Lael Brainard said when asked about the outsized jump in insurance costs. There's also a call to big business to bring down those prices that they increased so much when supply chains were snarled, he said. All of the U.S. government's independent agencies have a real focus on tackling unfair and deceptive price practices, Brainard said. Still unclear is the degree to which insurance costs alone can impede further progress on inflation and disrupt the outlook for Federal Reserve interest rate cuts later this year. It's hard for me to see how this might increase so much more from here that it would have an influence on monetary policy, Simons said. I don't think we're looking at another 10 to 20% increase from here for the next 12 months, but again, I'm no expert on insurance, he said. This is a great example of the sticky stuff in the inflation data, prices for services that are largely non-discretionary and have no substitute. Again, the title of that posted to Reuters, Remarkable Surge in Auto Insurance Costs Fans U.S. Inflation. This article is posted to Bloomberg. The title, Investors Flock to Gold on Geopolitical Risks, Fed Rate Cut Bets. Producer Price Index unexpectedly declined in December. Geopolitical concerns from airstrikes boost haven demand. This by Yvonne Yu Lee was posted on Friday, January 11, 2024. Gold jumped the most in a month after soft U.S. producer prices data amped up expectations of interest rate cuts, while U.S.-led airstrikes on Houthi rebel targets in Yemen stoked haven demand. Prices paid to U.S. producers unexpectedly fell in December for a third straight month, consistent with limited inflation at the wholesale level, Labor Department data showed Friday. The Houthi response to the U.S. and U.K. airstrikes is imminent, a senior political leader and member of ruling party Mohammed Ali al-Houthi said in a public speech. Treasury yields and the dollar weakened after the PPI report, while latest comments from the Houthi leader signaled a potential escalation of the situation in the Middle East. Those developments boosted bullion by as much as 1.6%, the biggest intraday jump in a month. Investors typically seek haven in gold in times of geopolitical and economic uncertainty. At the same time, they want to own the precious metal in a rate-cutting cycle. Bullion usually has an inverted relationship with rates. The lower the rates, the higher it climbs. While recent U.S. economic data point to a bumpy path ahead for policymakers trying to bring down inflation to a 2% target, traders appear to be focused on the timing and size of the Federal Reserve's shift to lowering borrowing costs. Despite daily price swings, bullion has stayed above the $2,000 an ounce level since December 13th, on expectations of the U.S. Central Bank's pivot to monetary easing. The U.S. and U.K. launched about 70 airstrikes on Houthi targets in Yemen early Friday in a bid to stop the Iran-backed group's shipping attacks in the Red Sea. The Houthis appear undeterred, vowing to continue targeting commercial vessels and saying they'd expand their campaign very soon. All U.S. and U.K. interests are now legitimate targets, the group said. Gold has responded to the increase in tensions, which clearly indicate that the West is slowly being drawn into the Middle East conflict, said Nikki Shields, head of metal strategy at Geneva-based MKS PAMP SA. It's another added support to gold, she said. Gold rose 1.3% to $2,055.49 an ounce as of 10:36 Friday in the morning in New York. Business World, a weekly program focusing on personal finance, retirement planning, and developments affecting the global economy. I'm listener-supported Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader Mike Amy. Thank you for listening.